I'm Dr. Denise Shervington, psychiatrist. Did you know that psychiatry is derived from the Greek term that means healing the soul? Well, welcome to Healing is the Revolution. This is where everyday people like us bear our souls as we try to learn from each other the naked truth of living. My guest today is poet extraordinaire, health advocate, health educator, Miss Nikki Napoleon. Nikki, welcome to Healing is the Revolution. As I always ask my guests, can you share with us into what situation you were born?
First of all, thank you, the honor to be here. I am one of nine children. Blessed just to be born into an amazing woman. My mother is just an amazing individual. My father wasn't. Just raised in a very abusive home. First, it started off with my mom. My dad was abusing my mother. And then it started off with, just trickling down to each of the children, my oldest brother, then my sister. And it was honestly just a very, very hard life. One, because you don't understand as a child, how you can be so unloved to a person who was supposed to be loving towards you. And second, because it makes you shrink inside as a child. And especially when you see other children laughing with their fathers and laughing with their families, and you look at yourself and you say, why can't I have that? So just make you like to shrink inside as a child. And it also just steals away who you are. It just steals away the light in your eyes. It steals away your voice. So many of those things growing up. And so that carries on into adulthood as well. And I know for my siblings and I, it has really been a major effect on us.
Can you share some examples of the ways in which he was abusive to either you, the children, or to your mom?
One of the most powerful things that I remember is around Christmas time. Christmas time was never loving. It was never, like the holiday cheer in our home. One of the most just powerful images that I remember from my mother and father, they were having, just a heated, debate. I'm not sure what it was about or who started it, but I do remember my father getting very angry and coming to the living room and looking at my brother and just getting mad and just start pitching things. And he goes to my oldest brother. My brother was maybe about 12 or 13 at the time. And my brother loved robots. He loved trains. And he had a desire to be an engineer. And so my dad begins to stomp on like his toys, like break them up. And my brother's looking at him and just crying. And he's saying, punk, you better shut up. And just, cursing at him. And so that was one of the most powerful memories that I had of my father. And I'm going to be honest, at that time is when I really realized that, my dad wasn't my dad. He was actually a monster.
How was he a monster to you?
He had this image, and this image that he portrayed to us and the image that he portrayed to everyone else was very different. He was very loving towards his coworkers, very loving towards his mother, very loving at church, those type of things. But at home, he was just this different person. And no one knew that we were being abused. People knew. But I think that everyone just closed their, their ears and their eyes to what happened to us. And even like the very moment when my father passed away, and I'm going to be honest, I remember when, my aunt called me like a week later and we were discussing all of the things that transpired in our home. And one of the things that she said was that, well, mental, abuse and emotional abuse has always been prevalent in our household. That's just learned behavior. And so I'm sorry that we couldn't do anything. And that made me realize that people knew what was going on, but they chose to be silent and cover their eyes.
And do you have any memories of any of the ways in which he was abusive to you?
Oh, ooh, that one. So I'm 5 years old. I'm sorry, because I always cry when I tell this story. I'm 5 years old, And my sister and I, my sister who's passed on, we were in the bathtub. And my father's yelling about all the bills he has to pay. My mother and father, they're arguing again. And so he comes and bang on the door and was saying, turn the water off, turn the water off. And so, of course, he busts open the door, breaks the lock, come in. And we're trying to both of us, we're trying to hurry up and get the water off, you know, because he's fussing about the water bill. And so he gets very angry and he said, okay, you want to turn the water on? And he turns the water on very, very hot, put my leg under the water and all my skin began to peel off, you know. And I remember he was telling my mom, don't call the police. They're going to come get all the children. So instead of that, my mother called my grandparents, and my grandparents took me during that time. And so I stayed with them for about 2.5 months. So I didn't go home. I didn't go to school. I don't even know if my mother reported. I'm not too sure what happened, but I remember staying with them for about 2.5 months.
What you said, being 5 years old and being burnt by hot water and your skin peeling off, do you remember how you felt at that time?
Oh, I remember just crying and screaming. That's, I'm going to be honest. And it was just, I was just terrifying because honestly, just seeing your skin, you know, peeling off, I thought I was going to die. Didn't know like that I was going to be okay or any of that, you know, until my grandparents, you know, came. My grandmother was just such a loving, always called her an earth angel. And until she came, she was very soothing and, you know, hugged me. And she's like, everything's going to be okay. And so I remember my brothers and sisters crying about what happened, you know, if I was going to come back home. And at that moment, I just realized, I was like, honestly, I didn't want to go back home. But so I spent a lot of my time just being in the presence of my maternal grandparents a lot.
Do you have any memories of any loving spaces at home with your father or your mother or together, other than with your grandmother?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm going to be very honest with you and say no. No. I mean, we created loving spaces among the siblings.
Can you tell me a little about, do you have any memories?
My oldest sister, her name is Eva, and actually she's named after my grandmother. And she was a very, very sweet, sweet soul. She loved children. And so we were actually her second children. And so she honestly took us under her wings, and she began to protect us from things that we didn't even have knowledge of until, you know, we got older. And she started explaining some things about the sexual abuse that she had experienced at the hands of my father, and how she was always told by everyone, don't say anything. Your dad makes money. Your mom doesn't work. You know, you guys are not going to be able to eat, and those type of things. And it really hurt me because I was like, I never knew that she always protected us. And she's like, that's why I never wanted you guys to be at home. That's why I always brought you guys with us. And it was loving to me because, you know, like, honestly, I was a child that always had this long, thick, thick hair. And I hated to get my hair combed. And so she would, like, sit me down in between her legs and, like, look, you have to get your hair combed. You're coming with me. And I'm like, no, I just want to stay home and read a book. And she's like, no, you're coming with me. And so we was out on the field, football, because she was a tomboy, playing, you know, with the guys playing basketball and those type of things. And so I remember, like, that space, you know, being loving with her and her being loving towards us and making certain that we were safe and protected.
You say was. Are you're referencing your sister in the past?
Yes. Yes. So I have I'm actually the oldest sister now. So I'm one of nine. So I have Sonya Latrice. She died when she was, and that story is a story within itself. My mom was actually pregnant with my sister, Sonya Latrice, when my dad was beating her. And so she was trying to get away from my father. And so he was beating her so bad that the baby died. And the baby was Sonya Latrice. And then I have my sister, Eva Napoleon, who I always talk about. And she actually died from a heart aneurysm. My brother, Jerry, who has That's the one who I always fight for. He has, you know, been a substance abuse user for so many years, just can never get over the trials of, you know, our life and like the hardship we endured. And then I have Yolanda, who has also passed on. And she's one of the reasons why I'm a strong HIV advocate.
Can you tell us about that reason?
So in during Hurricane Katrina, of course, you know, the family, everyone was just all split up, and we found ourselves in Houston, then moved on to Plano, Texas. And I remember my sister trying her hardest, saying that she needed to get, you know, back home because she needed to talk to her doctor. We never had no idea, you know, that she was battling HIV, and she didn't tell us. So she had kept it a secret for, I want to say, 6 years. And finally, she, you know, going from doctors to doctors, and they're saying, oh, we don't take care of HIV patients. You have to go over here. You have to go over there. Of course, she never told us until finally, 2008, she had been out of care for a long time. So that's almost 3 years. And she was finally able to get into care. But during that time, she had an AIDS diagnosis, and her T cell count was extremely too low. And she died from pneumonia. And so she's one of the reasons why I'm in this field, because while everybody else wanted to keep it a secret, my sister didn't. And so whenever I would see her, she would tell me all these stories about how she was feeling. We would laugh about the things that happened to us during our childhood, cry about the things that happened to us during our childhood. And I just began to write those stories. And I remember one of the things that she told me was that she's like, I'm not afraid if you share my story. And I thought that was so powerful because everyone wanted to say, oh, yeah, she died of cancer, and just, you know, because it was an embarrassment. But she was very proud, and she's like, I don't care. She was very open, you know, about, you know, who she was and how she contracted HIV. And so that's one of the main reasons why I became, you know, a part of this very, very strong network of individuals who are fighting to end the epidemic.
Did I misunderstand? You said initially she did not say what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But once she came out and said that she had HIV disease, mm-hmm. then she became a spokesperson?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like for you to have to deal with her death? What was that like?
One of the things I think it's her death and my sister's even death is so different because we knew her story early on. And even though it was very hard, she made it very comforting. And more or less like, you know, I'm sorry to have to put you guys through this, you know, but I'm tired. Those are the things that she used to say. And so I wasn't embarrassed by her or any of that. And like I said, because she wasn't embarrassed about, you know, having HIV. But it was very hard and a very hard transition because we are in the process of rebuilding, you know, our family home. You know, we're in the process of trying to make certain that we come, you know, just gain some stabilization. And while we're going through that, we're also trying to make certain that she's okay with doctor's appointments and, you know, in and out the hospital, back and forth, you know, people not wanting to visit. And so, you know, that was a select few, and I'm going to be honest, in my family who did come and see her. And I was just one of those individuals, and I'm thankful that, you know, I was able to love on her while she was here.
So at the time, there was the stigma around being able to be close to
yes.
someone who had HIV mm-hmm. disease.
Yes, mm-hmm. of course. And we have some family who, I remember, like one time I kissed her, and one of my cousins was in the room, and she was like, she gave this look and like, what are you doing? And I remember when I asked her about it, she was like, you know, are you're not afraid to kiss her? And I was like, why? That's not how you contract HIV. And she was like, oh, well, it's just some things I still want to do. And so I remember during that time, we were like actually arguing in the hallway, and then some nurse had to come and stop us. I'm like, don't visit her if you're going to feel this way. You know, if you're going to be uncomfortable with coming in the room, if you're going to be uncomfortable with us loving her and touching on her, don't visit, you know, those type of things, you know. And it's amazing to me that family still have that stigma, regardless, you know, of how you share the information about HIV, regardless of And what you said, even about individuals in the LGBT community, people will still like have their own great misnomers that they're going, that they create among themselves, based off of religion. And that's basically what my family had. Even though they were strong in religion, I always say that there wasn't any strength in love.
So in their religion, love was not a key part of it. What was the strength when you say they were strong in religion? What were the things that made them religious?
Attending church. And I'm going to be very honest. That's basically, it. Attending church, knowing the scriptures in the Bible from front to back, knowing the books of the Bible. But as far as imparting the things like kindness and love, and hate and being, being nurturing, those type of things, they didn't apply that to the life of God who they supposedly serve.
Just reflecting back on your saying that so many of your memories of childhood were negative in relationship to your parents. Then with the multiple losses you've had in your siblings and Katrina, can you talk to us about Katrina and how that impacted you as an individual, your family?
Oh, that honestly, that was a very trying time for us because, battling with my sister, her, HIV, moving to, AIDS diagnosis, rebuilding, and even just going through the process of Hurricane Katrina leaving and thinking that, we're packing for a couple of days and we're going to come back. And to see, the images on the news and some of the faces that you see are actually your family members in the water or friends that you've seen, and you're like, oh, my God, I hope that they're going to be okay. And to find out, no, they're not. And when those numbers begin to rise and in that number, those are friends, those are classmates. We in my family, we had two family members who passed away. And we always call my Uncle James, who is my dad's brother, the good person, because he was. He was one of the best people among the tribe. So it felt kind of bad to see that, months later, I think it was in February when he found his body. My cousin actually found his body. I actually told him, what house that he may have gone to, just thinking it's a speculation because he already said, I'm not leaving. But if I do leave, I'm going to go by my girl. If I don't leave, I'm going to go by my girlfriend's house. And so I remember telling my cousin, I say, well, he said he may be by his girlfriend's house. And that's exactly where he found him, right behind, this long bookcase, with his hands up, just bones, or what have not. And so that was very hard because the first person he called was me. And it was I felt bad because I remember asking him, do you want to come with us? And him saying, no, I don't want to come. So it made me think, wow, did I fail him? And I honestly had to deal with that for a long time. And in all honesty, that was the first time I actually got into therapy, the very first time.
I'm going to come back to you on therapy in terms of a healing strategy. Mm-hmm. So are you saying, for those who don't know much about Katrina, that his body was found about 7 months later?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was it like during those 7 months when no one knew what had happened?
Honestly, we were all clinging to hope, thinking that maybe, that he found himself somewhere, in Canada. I'm going to be very honest. We were like, whoa, he always talked about one day going to Canada. And so we had hoped that, he would have traveled that far, and just decided, I don't want to be bothered with anyone. And so for us, it was hard to find out, no, that didn't happen. Because we had been clinging to hope for so long, and we just felt so let down.
Was he by himself?
Yes.
Did you have a sense he was alone?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he was just a beautiful, effervescent light, just very beautiful in spirit. And I remember, even though my dad wasn't a provider, my uncle was, and so during Christmas time, and during Thanksgiving, he would come over every year bringing turkey, bringing food, and oh, you don't have to shop. I bought everything. I bought bell peppers. I bought this for you, for the family. So he would always do that during Christmas time and Thanksgiving, never, ask for anything in return, just nothing but love and hugs.
So, as he said, opposite to your dad,
yes.
His brother.
Oh, he was, yeah. Mm-hmm. My brother, my father is one of 13. Mm-hmm. And most of his brothers, they all have the same attitude, very hard men. And like my aunt always said, you know, they learned that behavior from my dad. My dad was the same way. He was very abusive, you know, and she has a large scar on her eye, you know, where her father hit her with the shovel. And so the same thing for my dad. My dad had scars on his body where his dad, you know, would beat him with 2x4s and different things like that. So the same thing that my dad experienced in life, he shared that experience with us. You know, so he was abused. And so, of course, you know, he felt that that was the way to raise us with tough love.
Hmm. I'm just taking a pause. I'm just taking a pause to just digest. And I know that it's challenging for you to be sharing this. But hopefully it is also very healing,
yes,
to be able to process these experiences and see the connection. Reflecting back on how you've described your early life, do you ever think you experienced a childhood?
To some degree, and that degree was with my grandparents.
Just tell me about,
yes,
your grandparents.
Like I said, my grandparents were just loving, especially my grandmother.
Your father's mother or your mother's
mother? Oh, no, ma'am. Okay. My father's mother was very mean, and yes. Actually, I never even talk about her because she was just such a dark, dark soul to us. And I really don't even refer to her as grandmother. Yes, I never will. And so her name was Luigi. So oftentimes when people say, you know, your grandmother, and I always say, oh, you're talking about Luigi or you're talking about my grandmother, you know, because that was like a distinct difference. Because she was kind of like my dad as well. You know, like in New Orleans, everyone loves gumbo. I don't love gumbo. My grandmother put pine sol in a gumbo, and we all ate it. So yes.
Can you say a little more?
Well, my grandmother never liked us by her home. So there was always, you have to stay in a certain room. And we were always taught, like, from young, you don't eat from her, don't get anything from her. And I'm going to be honest, we have never, ever received a hug from her. Or I love you. And I remember, like, when we were young, and my mother would give her, like, school pictures of us to put up. She would never put those pictures up. And she always referred to us as my dad's children, never by our names. You know, like, never Eva, never Maria. You know, we was always Jerry's children, or that girl, or that boy. And so I remember one day we were by her house, and this was maybe around Thanksgiving or Christmas time, I don't remember. And my dad brought us over there, and she, you know, fixed gumbo for us. And I remember my sister passing it up, and my dad was like, well, this is all y'all going to eat because I'm not going to get anything else. And this was the Christmas that my dad, or Thanksgiving, I'm not sure, like I said, that my dad decided that he wasn't going to get any food for the house so we can celebrate. And so we were over by her home, and she fixed gumbo for us. And we all kept saying, oh, it tastes funny. And my brother said, yeah, it tastes like pine sol. Well, we didn't think anything of it. They stopped eating, and I ate it all. And I remember just vomiting for a while. And I remember my siblings going home and telling my mom exactly, like, what it tastes like. And she said she accidentally put pine sol in the gumbo.
Instead of?
I don't know. She just said she accidentally. I'm going to be honest. To this day, I never found out what she was trying to put in there. But ever since then, I've never had a taste for gumbo.
Did you have to go to the hospital, or were you able to?
No, I was just vomiting up, yes. Mm-hmm. I remember my mother giving me milk. I remember she gave me milk during that time. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure what the cure was or why she gave me milk, but I remember milk.
How old were you then?
At that time, I was about 9. About 9, 10 years old.
So tell me about Good Grandma.
Oh, yeah. Good Grandma, she loved for us to comb her hair. She has long, beautiful hair. And so she would always give us nickels or quarters for combing her hair just right. And one of the beautiful things that she would always like to read, you know, to us, or, you know, vice versa. So she would always have books available in her home. And around the winter time is when she always had the heater out. So, you know, she was a praying grandmother, very loving, very, you know, like, oh, come give me a hug. You know, let me kiss your face, you know, those type of things. And so that's what I always, you know, remember, you know, about her all the time. And she just wore the baddest hats. And I remember, yeah, she just wore, I mean, I don't care where she was always a woman who was just regal. And she made certain that she imparted that to us as well. So that means that we couldn't be outside with rollers in our hair, a t-shirt on, those type of things. And even just the way that she dressed us, you know, it was very, you know, feminine for the boys, very masculine. But she never shrunk any of us, like saying, well, you can't be this. And I always remember her being that person, like even during the era when people was just coming out as being, you know, like I'm gay and stuff like that. And people would preach about and everything. And she's like, God loves everybody. You know, God loves everybody. And I had an uncle who would always go to jail and people would always talk about him. And she was like, God's going to change his life around. God loves everybody. You know, so she was just loving. And you never, you know, I'm going to be honest, I've never heard anything foul coming out of her mouth, you know, or whatever. And but there's this one thing that she would say, like if she wanted a curse, it was always dog taken in the manhole. I don't know what that meant. But we all know dog taken in the manhole is when she was mad at everybody or someone mm-hmm. did something. Mm-hmm. But as far as curse words, never a curse word that came out mm-hmm. of her mouth.
And she was grandma that you went to when yes. you got burned.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember her taking care
yes.
of you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's one of the reasons I fell in love with reading, because she bought me this whole collection of Dr. Seuss books. And from there, it became like this subscription to We Wisdom. And so that's how I just fell in love with books. I really fell in love with books because she would buy me so many during that time. And she wasn't really good at math, but reading, we just read together all the time.
Do you think that's why you're a poet now?
Yeah, actually, she was a poet.
Oh.
I didn't know it until like 5 years ago when my godmother told me. My grandmother said, did you know your grandmother wrote? And I said, wrote what? She said, poetry. And I said, Mom never told me. She said, yes, she wrote poetry. Never knew that.
You do have any of her poems?
No, we don't. Everything we lost in the storm. Everything. Yeah, so when Hurricane Katrina came, the house collapsed. So we couldn't get anything, save anything out of the house at all. And it was, yes, it was on the side where the levees breached. So, of course, there was nothing that we can get out that house.
But you, obviously, you all got out intact.
Yes, we did, yes. Mm-hmm. And so if we would have stayed, you know, because my mother, honestly, was living in that house during the time and with two of my siblings. So if they would have stayed, you know, it would have been, you know, a disaster.
It appears to me like you've had a lot of Katrinas in your life.
Yes.
But in spite of all of it, you have really found a way to connect to the positive, to be optimistic about life, and to do the things that you think are important to you. Can you tell me how you found that? Where did the spirit come from to rise above such negativity in your life?
I believe that the ancestors always walk with me. And so after just going through therapy, one of the things that, you know, that the therapist recommended was that you always cling on to something that's special. For me, that was my grandmother. She was just a beautiful spirit. And I don't care if she was having a bad day, someone else was having a bad day. She found a reason just to be just loving and always to have a kind word. And so I believe in mimicking that spirit. And that doesn't say I'm always going to walk like her. But I believe in mimicking her spirit. And my mother's that same way. My mother takes care of everyone in spite of everything that she's gone through. And even just talking with her and knowing that she's like, I made these bad decisions in not, you know, leaving your father. without realizing that there was things that my dad did to financially, not just emotional abuse and physical abuse, but financial abuse. You know, because I remember my mother having jobs and my dad, you know, putting us in the car and we going to my mom's job and he's, you know, fussing and raving about something and my mom gets fired and realizing he's doing that purposefully so she won't have any, you know, money to leave. And so I just think about like my mom's resilience through it all. And then at the age of 14, her deciding that she was going to leave, you know, and actually, you know, starting to go to the courts and, you know, report abuse. And my father knew a lot of people, a lot of judges in New Orleans, a lot. And so people protected him. And I remember he would never go to jail, even though we would share what was going on. And there were times my mom would just say, I'm not going to put my children on the stand for this. Because they would protect my dad. And it was like, oh, he's a good man. He was a longshoreman. And so everyone else saw that part of him instead of the bad side. And honestly, I did not want to be like him. And that's, I think, another reason. I did not want to be like him. And so, you know, in my life, I made it just my damnest to not be like him. Not be like him. And so that means like I always was at PTA meetings for my children. I'm always at report card conference. You know, I was a volunteer parent, you know, making certain I support my children instead of like tearing them down. And that's not to say I did everything right, but I made certain that I was there and that I imparted that love to them. Like even now, you know, hugging them and loving them, you know, even when they don't least expect it, I come behind them and say, I love you. And I never remember my dad ever saying that. Like, even with us hugging him, you know, he would, you know, like, literally push us away. Go, you know, those type of things. And I just never want to be that person. Never want to be that monster.
Was that when you chose to have a partner to have children with?
Mm-hmm.
Was thinking about your father an important part of how you chose your partner? Can you talk a little bit about that in
it's
terms
amazing.
Of their experience of their father?
Yeah, you know, and it's amazing that you say that because my children's their dad, when he became abusive, I did not do what my mom did. I said, I'm leaving. And that's what I did. And at first, he was such a loving person. And then when it began to turn sour and I recognized those signs, I did not stay. And my friends always wonder, oh, just how can you just get up and leave someone? And I said, I will not be my mother. I am my mother's child, but I will not be my mother. And so I just made a conscious decision that I will not raise him up in a house of abuse. Because I know, like, when a woman is abused, a lot of times that it always filters down to the child. And I will not tolerate that.
So initially you didn't see it coming. Do you think that's what happened to your mom?
Yes. Even to, like, my dad has passed on, and when I begin to share stories about our life story, people are like, I can't believe that your dad is such a loving person. And I remember when I decided I wanted to, like, just do, like, a short poetry book, you know, like, just short poems about our life. And I shared one on Facebook, and one of my cousins commented, and he said, well, did you eat? Your dad fed you. And he said something else. And I remember writing a poem to what he said. And that was when I realized, too, is that everyone doesn't see the monster that you see.
At this stage in your life, what are you hopeful about?
I'm hopeful for everything. Just grateful to be alive, that, you know, I have my mom here. Honestly, because in my family, it always end with the woman being killed. You know, so my mom's here. She's 74 years old, and that's a blessing. I'm here, especially when you hear now about, you know, men who are being very angry, even the woman being very angry, and, you know, of murder suicides. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful, you know, just to be here and just share my story and just to be authentic about it. Because at one time we were always taught, like, put buttons on your lips. Don't tell anyone. You know, you're only going to embarrass yourself. You're only going to embarrass your family. And you begin to recognize that people who said that, that's because they were allies or supporters of the person who abused you. And so you begin to recognize that they're just as sick as that individual. And so to ensure that I'm healthy, I make certain that, you know, I'm going to be truthful about the story. And not only just be truthful about the story, but make certain that, you know, whenever I feel the need, that I'm in therapy. And I don't go consistent, but when there's a need, I'm like, I'm going. Just like, you know, if I can spend money on something else, I always say therapy is so important. And that's important in the healing process. And so some of my siblings don't recognize that, and that's why they're still hurting, you know. And they, I have one brother who's, you know, addicted to alcohol, another that's addicted to, you know, drugs. And I realized with us being the older ones that our eyes saw too much. And so because our eyes saw too much, you know, we all, you know, had our vices and things that, you know, we had to, like, go through. For me, my vice was always poetry. It was always poetry. And so I'm just grateful to have that.
I think the visual of your skin being seared when your dad burnt you has kind of stayed with me. What does that scar mean to you now when you see it? What do you think about?
Now, honestly, I have a short piece I wrote about that because when I talked about that, one of my dad's friends said, that's the past. And so I wrote a short poem for that one. And I was just, you know, just reflecting off what happened because that's the scar that I wear every day. And even though, you know, it has minimized in color, that's what I have to look at. And so, you know, it's hurtful because when you look at that scar every day, you're like, this is from a person who, you know, actually gave birth to me, a person who was supposed to be loving but wasn't so loving. And so it hurts when people say you get over the past. And I don't think that's something that I would ever be able to get over, especially when I see that scar every day. When that scar is visible, you never get over that.
Can you share with us how you discovered that you can write, that you particularly liked poetry, the hardest form of writing?
Actually, I started off in the sixth grade. I was in the library, and the librarian, I remember her name was Miss Harrison, and I'm almost certain she knew what was going on in our life. And I loved books, and I would always just check out books. And so she recommended a book for me, and it was Nikki Giovanni.
And what's your name?
Yes. Yes, Nikesha, but everyone calls me Nikki. Uh-huh. And so she recommended the book, and I read her, the poetry book in the sixth grade and became just amazing. Like, oh, this is some beautiful writing. I didn't even know what poetry was. Never been introduced to poetry until Miss Harrison gave me that book. And from there, I began to write. And I had about 4 or 5 bins of poetry that I kept up from sixth grade up until 2005. But like I said, I lost all of that work in the storm. There was nothing that could be salvaged. Yeah, so I lost all of that work in the storm. I had short stories and just poems and children books I was writing. And I never thought to publish. I was just like my grandmother. I just love to write.
How do you get into that rhythm and know which words to choose that will get across in one sentence the probably ideas that it takes some people 10 paragraphs to write?
One, I draw from personal experience. And just like as a child, you know, I was a canvas. And it depends on who draws on your canvas. My father and mother, they drew on my canvas. And so from that became life experiences. And so for poetry, it's like a blank canvas to me. And so I'm the painter, so I have the opportunity to choose what I'm going to write. And so for me, it's mostly childhood stories and mostly love poems and just short, powerful quotes. And I mesh those together. And what I do, I love like to invoke the senses, like music, things that I smell, your colors, and those different things. And so putting it all together on my canvas, that makes me just feel happy. And it's very cathartic, very cathartic. You say that the past be the past, but there's a scar on my skin. It looks like death. It looks like crawling roaches and ants. I wear that scar every day. I wear these pain, I wear these blues. It feels like music. It feels like hands cutting my throat. It doesn't feel like love. This scar is forever my keeper.
If before the age of 18 years, a child experienced physical, sexual or emotional abuse, or physical or emotional neglect, or grew up in a household where a mother was being hurt, or someone in the household was mentally ill, or suicidal, or a substance abuser, or incarcerated, the seminal adverse childhood study, the ACEs, found a graded risk for developing physical and mental illness over the life course, meaning that the more adversity suffered, the greater the chance of developing illnesses such as depression, substance use, cancer, heart, liver, and lung disease. In fact, those with six or more ACEs were found to be more likely to die 20 years earlier. Nikki and her siblings were exposed to many ACEs during their childhood. Domestic violence, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. When her father scalded her with hot water, Nikki stated she felt she was going to die, a hallmark of developing PTSD. As if her childhood maltreatment was not enough, Hurricane Katrina added more. Her sister fell out of HIV care during the relocation and succumbed to AIDS shortly thereafter. And her uncle, her good father figure, drowned. And his body was not discovered until 7 months later, which created much guilt and added to her traumas. Nikki's story is exemplary of the intergenerational transmission of trauma, especially in her paternal lineage. Both her grandparents were abusive and passed it on to their son, Nikki's father. Luckily, Nikki's maternal grandmother, her uncle, and her older sibling provided much loving protection and buffers. And these supports allowed Nikki to develop the resilience she needed to survive, heal, and thrive. Nikki shares that she uses healing methods such as ancestral reverence, creativity, and psychotherapy. I discuss these methods in Healing is the Revolution in much more details, specifically chapter 9 and chapter 13. Nikki's story teaches us that we can overcome the traumas of early childhood, but it begins with starting the process of getting to better know and observe ourselves. So please Google ACEs anywhere on the internet and do yours. And if you score more than 3, I refer you back to Healing is the Revolution in chapter 8, where you can complete the screener for PTSD, anxiety, and depression. If you score positive for any of these disorders, please seek help. In addition to all the other tools mentioned previously that you can use for your healing. As was stated by Vincent Felitti, one of the architects of the ACEs study, traumatic events of the earliest years of infancy and childhood are not lost, but like a child's footprint in wet cement, are often preserved lifelong. Time does not heal the wounds that occur in those years. Time conceals them. They're not lost. They are embodied.
Thank you for listening to Healing is the Revolution. If you want to learn more about healing trauma on an individual, family, or community level, Dr. Shervington's new book, Healing is the Revolution, can help you. Look for it on Amazon.com. Healing is the Revolution is brought to you by IWES, the Institute of Women and Ethnic Studies. IWES provides community-based programs and workshops that enhance mental health and emotional resiliency. Operating since 1993, the Institute of Women and Ethnic Studies is an organization founded upon the principles of healing, collaboration, compassion, and love. To learn more, please visit iwesnola.org.